Well, good morning. I think that what I'd like to do this morning is to take you on a museum tour through a portrait gallery. And after we complete the portrait gallery, then we'll get some dioramas that we'll look at. This is obviously metaphorical. But it's a helpful way of thinking of Christian biography. And I have 8 or 9 very brief biographies that I want to present to you. And then I want to talk about some of the churches. I've reworked the material in my mind just a little bit. And I want to get to some biblical and theological matters about our faith this evening and what our brothers from the past can teach us. And so I'm hoping to be able to get through this material today. And I think the figure of a museum tour is a very helpful one. So imagine yourself as part of a tour group, and I'm the tour guide, and we're walking through the gallery, and we'll stop before some portraits, and I'll have a few things to say about the individuals who are in the portraits. Now, the best thing that we could do right now would be if we had some kind of PowerPoint presentation and could put their portraits up on a screen and we could look at them. But actually, several of these men, we don't even know what they looked like. A couple of them, I could put portraits up for you and give you an idea of what they looked like. But others, I've never seen. I don't know of in existence any portrait of them. You know, they look very interesting when you do see them in a picture. One of the things that I noticed is that they all had big noses. And I don't know what the significance of that is, but when you see the pictures from the 17th century, they all seem to have big noses. They also had long hair, most of the men. That seemed to have been the style. And so probably many of you have seen the picture of John Bunyan with his shoulder-length hair. That would not have been unusual. My guess, and it's simply a guess as to why many of them wore long hair, was that, I suppose, for two reasons. Number one, it was cold in the wintertime, and long hair gave some warmth. And secondly, hygiene back then wasn't what it is today, and it was difficult to cut your hair and do all of those things. It must have been a painful experience to have a haircut, actually, with whatever they had to cut your hair. So I'm assuming that for those reasons, they left their hair long. Now, so I want you to come with me now to this portrait gallery. And in some ways, we'll be picking up on some themes that were mentioned last night. The question was asked, where did these leaders come from? What was their background and experience? Well, that's what I'll tell you now. And some of them were men who were trained up at the university, who had been ordained in the Church of England. Others were more or less what we'd call laymen, who rose to positions of leadership in their churches. The first one that I want to talk about is John Spilsbury. I mentioned him last night. If you remember, in the Jacob Lathrop Jesse Church, the second separation that took place in 1638 was under the leadership of Spilsbury. Remember that church formed in 1616 as a semi-separatist congregation in London? They didn't throw stones at the Church of England. They tried to maintain a cordial relationship. But as pressures came from outside, as Charles I came to the throne and then William Laud came to be Archbishop of Canterbury, there was a great deal of pressure that was placed upon the Puritans, and it was much more difficult to recognize and support the Church of England, and a stronger view of separation developed in the church. So in 1633, one group hived off and separated and formed a new congregation that caused the issue of baptism to be raised in the congregation. And in 1638, Spilsbury led a group off to begin a congregation that was based on the principle of believers' baptism. Now, we don't know a whole lot about Spilsbury. We have to put together the story of his life from a variety of sources. But it, most likely he was born way back in 1593. So that in 1638, when he begins his church, he's almost 40 years old. Early in his life, he seems to have been a cobbler. When I was a boy, we had a cobbler in our neighborhood. I don't know that there are too many cobblers around anymore. Does anybody remember what a cobbler is? Right, a person who works on shoes and repairs shoes. We had one just down the street from where I lived. He was part, as we've said, of the Jacob Lathrop Jesse Church. And some of those ancient records that I mentioned last night have this statement in them. They say that several individuals, being convinced that baptism was not for infants, but professed believers, joined with Mr. John Spilsbury. This church was the first of the Baptist churches, the Calvinistic Baptist churches in England, and it quickly came under the notice of some opponents. Now, one of them put together a scurrilous little rhyme about Spilsbury. His name was John Taylor. He's an interesting character. He's called the Water Poet. The reason that he's called the Water Poet is that he traveled around England on these little waterways, canals. So you can do it today as sort of a vacation opportunity. You can rent a little boat and you can sleep on the boat. You can travel in the canals of England. I've seen the canals a couple of times, but don't know much about them except that they are ancient. And Taylor, this water poet, traveled around England and he wrote poetry about his experiences in traveling. Well, when he was in London, Spilsbury and the Church of Spilsbury came under his gaze. And so from his pen came this poem about Spilsbury. It's a little bit hilarious. It goes like this. Also one Spilsbury rose up of late, who doth or did dwell over Aldersgate. His office was to weigh hay by the truss fit for the palate of Bucephalus. He in short time left his hay-weighing trade, and afterwards he Irish stockings made. He rebaptized in Anabaptist fashion one Eaton of the newfound separation, a zealous button-maker, grave and wise, and gave him orders others to baptize, who was so apt to learn in one day, he'd do it as well as Spilsbury weighed hay. Now that's a curious little poem, isn't it? He picks up the fact that Spilsbury had a variety of jobs that would have been considered to be fairly low-class jobs. And the implication of this is, who does John Spilsbury think that he is? That he can go from the lower classes, take upon himself, according to Taylor, the responsibility of baptizing others, and then lead forward a church. He doesn't have any education. He doesn't have any authorized ordination. What right does he have to do this? So this is intended to ridicule Spilsbury and this other fellow, John Eaton, who's mentioned along the way. Now, Spilsbury, in 1643, published one of the earliest books about believers' baptism, and he defended the increasing number of Calvinistic Baptist churches that were developing in the city of London. And in 1644, his name is the first name that is appended to the first edition of the London Confession of Faith. You know, I'm sure, that there were two major confessions that came from the Baptists in London. Ours is best called the Second London Confession. There was a First London Confession that was published in 1644 and then revised and republished in 1646. Spilsbury's name is right at the top. And it makes sense that his name is at the top because he was the pastor of the first of their churches. Now, we don't know exactly what his relationship to that First London Confession was, but there are some scholars who have suggested that possibly he was the primary author. And that's a fair suggestion based upon the evidence that we have. One British Baptist historian named A.C. Underwood calls Spilsbury the great patriarch of the Anabaptist Confession. And an American scholar who only died within the last couple of years, R.L. Greaves, said He was a signatory and probably the principal author of the particular Baptist confession. And Lumpkin, in his book Baptist Confessions of Faith, suggests that Spilsbury played a major part in its preparation. Now, we don't know for sure, but I would say that those are probably fairly decent guesses. We see him appearing a couple more times in the 1640s and 50s, signing various books. When the Baptists first come to light, they are considered to be a sect. They're heretical. They are hounded and persecuted. Last night I told you the story of Daniel Featley. Another man that we could mention is a fellow named Thomas Edwards. He was a Presbyterian minister in London, and he wrote a very famous work against everybody who wasn't a Presbyterian, and the Baptists are included in it. And he's known by his nickname. He's actually known by the title of the work that he wrote. And the title of the book, the title he gave to the book was Gangrena. And so he's known as Gangrena Edwards. Now, you know what gangrene does. It's an infection that attacks the body. And those who suffer from gangrene often lose part of their bodies, or they might even lose their life if it develops severely enough. Well, he chose that title for his book to say, we need to cut these people off or else they will cause great damage in the country of England. Gangrena Edwards went after the Baptists very strongly in that book. And Spilsbury comes under attack from Gangrena Edwards in it. That tells us that he was a man of prominence and that he was recognized even by others in terms of the influence that he had in the city of London. Now, Spilsbury very quickly is joined in leadership among the Baptists by perhaps the most famous man of all, whose name is William Kiffin. And it's worth me pausing here to tell you the story of Kiffin, because he's the guy probably that we all should know really well. Kiffin was a little bit younger than Spilsbury, being born in 1616, so that would make him 23 years younger than Spilsbury. Spilsbury probably died in the 1660s, where Kiffin lived until after 1700. So he lived well over 80 years. Kiffin was an orphan. His parents died of plague. You know, it's very interesting to think about England and some of the great tragedies that came upon them. And one of them regularly was plague. We don't even struggle with plague anymore. But in 1666, for example, there was an outbreak of plague in London, and 20% of the population died. That's one out of every five people died as a result of plague. Imagine what that would be like in any of our cities today if one out of every five individuals died, had to be buried as a result of some kind of calamity. That's what it was like. Kiffin's parents were both taken by the plague, and so he grew up as an orphan. He was apprenticed early in a trade, and when he was just a young man, he and a friend began the practice of going to hear sermons preached before they went to work in the morning. Now, that means that there were probably every day in London you could go to a sermon about 6 o'clock in the morning. Now, before you think that they were really, really spiritual, you have to remember something about them. And that is that it was a culture where there was no electricity. And so when it got dark at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, unless you had enough candles to light your home, there really wasn't anything else to do but to go to bed. So their bedtime would have been much, much earlier than our bedtime would have been. And so when they have a meeting at 6 o'clock in the morning, it's not quite as impressive as it might sound, because that's actually later in the day relative to the time that you and I get up, if you understand the point that I'm making. Well, Kiffin, and of course, they still had to use the daytime hours to do their jobs, to do work, because you needed light. And especially in the wintertime, there was very little light. The sun probably wouldn't rise until 9 o'clock in the morning, perhaps, and it would be setting by 3 or 3:30 in the afternoon. So you had to make hay while the sun shines, even though you couldn't make hay in the middle of winter, but you understand the principle. Kippen and his friend would go off to hear these Puritan sermons at 6 o'clock in the morning or so. And as a result of this, he was converted to faith in Christ. He heard through the preaching of the word, the gospel of Jesus Christ, and came to make a profession of faith and joined up, interestingly, with the Jacob Lathrop Jesse Church. Now, he seems to have stayed with them for a while, and probably after the 1642 baptism ceremony, we find that Kippen becomes the leader of a church in London itself. At this point, he's still a relatively young man. Let's see, if it's 1642, he's 36 years old. He becomes pastor of this church in Devonshire Square in London and becomes really the most important leader among all the Baptists. Now, he's another guy who doesn't have any theological training. He hasn't been to Oxford or Cambridge. He hasn't had the opportunity for learning to know the languages, to be exposed to the history of theology, to work through exegesis and theological writings. But he's a man of keen mind and of great success in his career. He becomes the pastor of the Devonshire Square Church, and at the same time, he supports himself by means of an import-export business, seemingly especially with the Netherlands, although also across the Atlantic at some point. And he became an incredibly wealthy man. Now, how wealthy did he become? Well, let me tell you a story. I can't prove to you that this story is true, although you'll find it in almost all the books, and most people tell it, and they tell it with the caveat that it might not be true, but it sounds like it's true. And it could well be true. So here's the story. Let me give you some context for this. In the Baptist churches, it would be typical for a pastor annually to receive a wage of about 25 to 40 pounds, pounds sterling, which was the currency in England. So when you hear 40 pounds, you have to think in terms of an annual wage. Let's say that that's the equivalent of $40,000, which might be an annual salary today. 40 pounds a year would have been a livable wage. Well, Kippen, because of the wealth that he had accumulated through his business dealings, became known at court. And King Charles II, who was always in need of money and always looking for someone that he might be able to take some money from, sent a letter of some kind to William Kippen and suggested to Kippen that he would like to receive from Kippen a loan of 40,000 pounds. Now, remember what I just said, a decent salary, a livable salary for a pastor would have been about 40 pounds. The king asked Kippen for 40,000 pounds. Now, Kippen was a shrewd businessman. To be able to have any amount of money, he had to know how to put two pennies together. And he recognized that it would be a serious mistake to loan Charles II 40,000 pounds because he'd never see that money again. So he sent a letter, or so the story goes. He composed a letter and sent it back to the king, and it went something like this. My lord the king, I cannot see my way clear at the moment to loan you 40,000 pounds, but if you will receive as a gift these 10,000 pounds, I will continue to be your loyal servant, William Kippen. And thus Kippen was able to give to the king a gift of 10,000 pounds. Now, that's absolutely enormous amount of money. But it seems that that's the success that William Kippen had. And there's a very famous portrait of him. If you go home and you Google William Kippen portrait, you'll be able to pull it up pretty quickly on the internet. And it shows him dressed up in very impressive clothing. He's the only particular Baptist for whom we have this kind of portrait that was very common in the day for wealthy individuals to hold. And you can see by the dress that Kippen is wearing that he was a wealthy man. We know that he was able to buy a manor house 40 or 50 miles north of London. And you had to have a lot of money to be able to buy one of those big manor houses up there. He was also a man who was approached at several times to be an alderman in the city of London. You only got those kind of approaches if you were a man of means. Now, Kippen used his money very well, and he was very willing to support the work of God in other places. He was a generous man with his funds. We said last night, someone asked the question, how much interchange was there between the particular Baptist and the general Baptist? And my answer was not much. But there is a very famous story about Kippen and the general Baptist that needs to be told. He learned in the 1660s, in the time of persecution, that there were, if I remember correctly, 12 general Baptists who had been arrested and who were actually in danger of being executed because they had met together outside of the worship of the Church of England. And Kippen was able to use his connections in the government to get all of these people released and set them free. So he was a man of generous spirit who used both his money and his position well to help others. He wrote several important works on baptism and church membership. And what's very interesting is that the man that he wrote against the most is perhaps one of the most famous Puritans of the era, and that is John Bunyan. Now, in my story that I tell, John Bunyan doesn't have very much of a part. And the reason for that is that there was a significant conflict between John Bunyan and the Baptists, the confessional Baptists in London. And they didn't get along very well. Bunyan didn't consider himself to be one with them, nor did they consider Bunyan to be one of their own. And Kippen, being the leader of the particular Baptists, not officially, but in fact the leader, he wrote against Bunyan. Now, if you go home and if you have John Bunyan's works on your shelf, you can take them down and you'll find that there are three brief works that John Bunyan wrote. And in those works, you'll find the initials W.K., or you might even find Kippen's name spelled out. He's writing against Kippen. Now, what was the issue? The issue was baptism. Now, Bunyan did believe in believers' baptism, but Bunyan believed that it was irrelevant to the church. That is, that it was a matter of personal conviction, not a matter of church practice and church discipline. And so Bunyan's congregation in Bedford was organized around the principle of open membership. That is, that baptism had no relationship to membership in the church in Bedford. You could be baptized as a believer. You could be baptized as an infant. You could be not baptized at all. It was irrelevant to your membership and participation in the Bedford church. But the confessional churches in London are what we call closed membership churches. That is, they required believers' baptism for membership in their midst. And so there was this debate that went on back and forth between Kippen and a couple of other men in London and Bunyan up in Bedford, in which Kippen and the others in London are trying to demonstrate that baptism is necessary for membership in the Church of Jesus Christ. And Bunyan, on the other side, is writing that baptism is not necessary for membership in the Church of Christ. Now, if you go home and you look up those things, one thing I need to tell you, and Bunyan has often been misread when people have looked up these articles, Bunyan uses the word church communion. And he doesn't mean the Lord's Supper, which we will be observing later on this morning. We have come to use the word communion to describe the Lord's Supper. When Bunyan uses communion, the word communion, he means membership in the church. That's what he's concerned with. Now, the Lord's Supper, what we call communion, was to be the high point of membership. That's where the members communed with one another. And thus, over the years, the language has changed, and we've lost that sense of communion as membership, but we've maintained it in terms of our participation at the table. For them, it was a broader concept, and communion means church membership. So Kippen writes against Bunyan, his most famous book, published in 1681, is called A Sober Discourse of Right to Church Communion. Kiffin dies in 1702. He had a long, really amazing life. His story has been told a couple of different times. He actually wrote an autobiography, which was published in two different versions about 150 years ago. And then an English pastor, B.A. Ramsbottom, a couple of years ago, published a life of Kiffin that he called Stranger Than Fiction. And it's very interesting, and you could find that if you wanted to and read about him. But he certainly is the most famous of all of the particular Baptist leaders. Now, another couple of companions of Kiffin, I'm talking here about the earliest leaders, two more that deserve to be mentioned are Benjamin Cox and Hansard Knowles. And I think I'll tell the story of Knowles before I tell the story of Cox. They both come into the particular Baptist churches at about the same time. Knowles was another older man, born in 1598. So when he shows up in about 1645, he's 47 years old. Now, he lived until 1691. So he lived till he was 93 years old. And if you take a look at our Confession of Faith, the Second London or the 1689, and if it has the list in the back of men who signed it, the first name at the top is the name Hansard Knowles. The reason for that, well, there are probably two reasons for that. Number one, he was the oldest of them all. He was, in many ways, the senior minister, and they showed a certain level of respect to him by putting his name at the top. But also, his church in London was the church that hosted the General Assembly of particular Baptist churches in 1689, where our Confession of Faith was adopted. So he was the host pastor. Your pastor and I were talking the other day about the fact that this facility could well host the General Assembly of the Association of Reformed Baptist Churches of America. And if you were to host that General Assembly, it would be opened by Pastor Doug standing in this pulpit and calling the meeting to order. Well, Knowles seemed to have been the man who did that in 1689 in London. Knowles was a Puritan minister. He had attended Cambridge University, so he had theological training, and he received a Master of Arts degree from Cambridge. It's interesting what he did. He went right into the Church of England, and he went through two ordinations in two consecutive days, which is a little bit unusual. Nevertheless, it was the case. Now, the Church of England had a very unusual church structure, and it had many, many different kinds of offices. He was ordained in one day as a deacon. Now, their deacon was not the same as our deacon. Their deacon was a ministerial or ecclesiastical office. And it was oftentimes the stepping stone into the priesthood or to be a pastor. Sometimes they were called priests, even in 1629. Knowles was ordained deacon one day, and the next day he was ordained priest. It was very unusual to go in that short succession from the one to the other, but he did. And he became a minister of the Church of England. Now, 1629 is right at the time when Charles I is on the throne, and William Laud, remember him? Aggressive Arminianism, high church sacramentalism. William Laud is coming to power. Knowles begins to serve in the Church of England, but he is very concerned with what William Laud is imposing upon the Puritan ministers. And so as a matter of conscience, in 1636, he resigned from the ministry of the Church of England. He was persecuted, and he fled to New England. He took a ship, came across the Atlantic, landed in Boston, and made his way north to Dover, New Hampshire. Spent a couple of years up there in Dover, New Hampshire, got in trouble, had some disputes over separatism and independency and the Puritan churches. And by this time, Knowles was a little bit radicalized in his views and wasn't willing to submit to the state church, what was essentially a state church up there in New Hampshire. And so in 1641, he returned to England. It's also true that his father at this time was gravely ill, and it may have something to do with his return to England. Now, around 1645, or when he returns to England, he gets involved with, guess what, the Jacob Lathrop Jesse Church. And his wife has a child, and he has a scruple of conscience at this point about whether or not his baby should be presented for baptism, and he comes to the conclusion that he will not allow his child to undergo that ceremony. It's very controversial. And a council is held in London in which several very famous Puritan ministers are called in to help to resolve the situation and sort through it. And that Puritan council, which included men like Thomas Goodwin and Jeremiah Burroughs, conclude that Hansard Knowles's conviction of conscience should be allowed. That is, that no one should force him to practice infant baptism. And so he doesn't do it, and he undergoes believer's baptism, and a new church is formed in London, and he becomes its pastor. And for the next 46 years, until 1691, he is the pastor of that church. The history of that church is very interesting. They go through all kinds of periods of persecution. At one point, Knowles has to flee to the continent of Europe in order to get away from the persecution. He supports himself as a school teacher. He wrote some very interesting books that have been published, but among them are a Latin grammar and a Hebrew grammar. So he was a man who was well skilled in the languages and was able to use his knowledge as a means to support himself along the way. He also seemed to have been something of a prophecy buff. And he wrote a couple of books about prophecy in 1688, an exposition of the whole book of the Revelation. In 1681, The World That Now Is and The World That Is to Come. And they're actually very interesting books to read. Now, I wouldn't recommend them to you. I don't think that necessarily they're very good, but they are interesting. For example, in 1681, well, let me back up. The method of interpreting the book of Revelation that was very common in those days is called historicism. And what that word refers to is the belief that the book of Revelation was given to John and through John given to the church as something of a prehistory of what would happen between the advents of Christ. Christ had ascended into heaven. The church was waiting for him to return. And the book of Revelation was given in mysterious and dark and difficult form. Nevertheless, it was given so that the church might know what was ahead as they waited for the return of Christ. So when you read expositions of the book of Revelation from the Reformation and Puritan era, you find that they're always struggling to ask and answer the question, at what point are we in the book of Revelation? And they try to identify different events in that book and say, well, this is what happened here, and this is what happened here, therefore we must be at this point. For example, many interpreted the two witnesses who come to Jerusalem and testify as Calvin and Luther. And so if Calvin and Luther are the two witnesses, then we're somewhere beyond that in the book of Revelation. Well, Knowles, in his exposition of the book of Revelation, came to the conclusion that actually the two witnesses were not Calvin and Luther, but they were two individuals who would come to London. London was this terrible city, this Babylon the Great. London was the center of wickedness in the world. And the two witnesses would come to London, and they would prophesy for 3.5 days, and they would be killed in London, and then they would come back to life again in London. And then he, in putting together all of his chronology, he believed that something of great importance would happen, and that perhaps Christ would return in the year 1688. Well, what's really interesting is that Christ didn't return, but James II, who was on the throne at that time, was removed from the throne, and William and Mary came to the throne in 1688. He did get the fact that something monumental in the history of England would happen that year, but it wasn't exactly what he expected. Now, we read these things and we say, well, that's quaint and that's interesting, but that's the reality of the type of exposition that they did of the book of Revelation. Very interesting character, man who lived a long life, who suffered as a result, but who was known to be a very faithful pastor, and his church was a very important church that hosted the General Assembly. I can see that our tour through the museum is going much slower than I expected it to go, and we probably won't get as far as I had hoped to go. Let me talk about one more of the early leaders, and that's Benjamin Cox. Now, Benjamin was another minister of the Church of England, born probably around 1595, a little bit older than Hansard Knowles was, but he died around in the mid-1600s, so he didn't live nearly as long as Knowles did. He was a graduate of Oxford in 1613 and in 1617, and became a minister in the Church of England. Now, there is reason to believe that as a young man in the ministry of the Church of England, he was an advocate of William Laud's high sacramental view. There's a couple of indicators that point in that direction. But at some point, probably in the early 1640s, there were questions of conscience in Benjamin Cox's mind. And we can see in the works that he published in the early 1640s a progression. He begins to ask the question, or he begins to ask questions about the Lord's Supper. And who rightfully ought to be allowed to come to the Lord's Supper? Now, in the Church of England, when the parish church is basically equivalent to the village, that is, everybody who lived within the boundaries of that village belonged to the Church of England and was welcome to come, the minister could not, generally speaking, prevent anyone from coming to the Lord's table. And so, if you were a conscientious minister and you recognized that there were individuals in the parish who were members of the congregation but whose lives were immoral, maybe they were drunkards, maybe they were thieves, maybe they were involved in impure actions, still they could come and participate in the table. And Cox began to have questions about this, and he wrote a book in which he advocated a more careful fencing of the Lord's table to keep away individuals who are known to be openly in sin. When you read that book, you get the sense that he's beginning to think very deeply about the ordinances of Christ and about the right way to observe those ordinances. It's no surprise to me that within about 2 years of the publication of that work, he's gone beyond his concerns, his scruples of conscience with the Lord's Supper, and has now come to a conviction that not only should immoral people be kept from the table, they ought to be kept out of the church. Only those who profess faith in Christ and submit to believers' baptism ought to become part of the church. And so Benjamin Cox comes to be identified with the particular Baptists. We find him in 1646 signing the second edition of the First London Confession of Faith. He becomes very active outside of London in one of the early associations of churches just to the west of London in an area known as Abingdon, and spends the rest of his life, about the last 20 years of his life, in leadership among the particular Baptists. Now, why is Cox important? Why do I mention him here? Well, for two reasons. He, along with Knowles, is one of the ministers of the Church of England who came out of that body and had been trained at the universities and took up leadership role among the particular Baptists. This helps us to see that not all of the early leaders were men who didn't have any kind of theological training at all. In fact, Cox wrote a couple of books that are pretty good theological pieces, and we're able to discern that by reading them. But also, more importantly, Cox is the first generation of two men who are of great importance for our history. The second is his son, Nehemiah Cox. Now, I know that you've heard that name before. Some of you may have read Nehemiah Cox's book, A Discourse of the Covenants That God Made with Men Before the Law. I helped to bring that book back into print. Benjamin had a very high view of baptism. He believed that it was necessary for membership in the church, And what happened to his son later on in life is probably a result of his father's influence upon him. Now, time's running away, and I don't want to tell the story of... Well, I suppose I can move on to the story of Nehemiah at this point, can't I? I don't have to go in the order that my notes are in. Let me tell you the story of his son, Nehemiah Cox. In 1669, we actually don't know when Nehemiah was born, though we do know when he died. He died in 1688. If you have that copy of the Confession of Faith that has the 37 names on it, Nehemiah Cox's name isn't there. And the reason that it isn't there is that he was dead. He had already died. He was a young man when he died, but his name is not there. And I think that in a sense that's tragic, because in many ways he's the most important of all of these men, at least in terms of our Confession of Faith. He was Benjamin's son. In 1669, we find him, very interestingly, as a member of John Bunyan's church in Bedford. And do you remember what we said before about the conflicts between the men in London and Bunyan in Bedford? Well, Nehemiah Cox appears as a member of Bunyan's church in Bedford. In 1674, in the church book of the Bedford church, there is a note that Nehemiah Cox was censured by the church for certain miscarriages. That's what it says. He committed some miscarriages and he was censured. This is the note that he wrote in his own hand in that church book. He said, "Whereas several words and practices have been uttered and performed by me that might justly be censured to have a tendency to make rents and divisions in the congregation, I do declare myself unfeignedly sorry and repentant for the same." Now, we've come to read this language and wonder, what were his miscarriages? Why was he censured in the church? And some have suggested, and I think it makes perfect sense to me, that the censure was a result of Nehemiah's advocating his father's position on baptism in Bunyan's church. Bunyan's church was built on the principle of open membership. Benjamin was a defender of the closed membership principle. His son becomes part of that congregation in Bedford. His son is censured for, as he puts it, words that have the tendency to make rents and divisions in the church. A rent, or to rend the church apart, to rent and divide the church. If Nehemiah is advocating the principle of closed membership, it makes sense that he would be censured by that congregation. And interestingly enough, he apologizes. But a year later, he appears again as pastor of the Petit France Church in London, probably one of the two most important and most famous of the early particular Baptist churches. Now, we don't know where he was educated, but he was a man who obviously had a university education because he was a qualified physician. He was skilled in Latin, in Greek, and in Hebrew. And he was a very discerning theologian. I've been able to read all of his theological works. I've been very impressed with his grasp of theology. It's clear that he was very carefully trained in theology. He was approached by the leaders of London to take up the cause of defending the truth. And it has been suggested, and I think rightly suggested, that he is probably the co-editor of our Confession of Faith itself. The first known literary reference to our Confession of Faith is found in the Petit France church book. It appears first there. And the most likely conclusion that we can draw from that is that Nehemiah Cox and his co-elder, well, mentioned in just a minute, William Collins, are the two men who edited that document, proposed it to their church, and then from their church it went out to other churches as well. That's the best suggestion that's been made. I've been convinced by it. In fact, I've seen material that strengthens that argument in my own mind. And so I think that Cox is probably the editor of our confession, along with his friend William Collins. On the same day that Cox was ordained to be pastor of the Petit France Church in London, so also Collins was ordained alongside of him. And like Nehemiah, he was a university graduate, but we don't know which university he attended. We know that he was a bachelor of divinity. He had offers to join the Church of England, but refused because it was a matter of conscience for him that he could not join the Church of England. And we find him being ordained on the same day with Cox as pastor of the Petit France Church in London. In 1693, Collins is approached by the Baptists in London, and he's asked to draw up a catechism to go along with the Confession of Faith. Now, that's one of the reasons that I think Cox and Collins probably were the authors of the Confession. Cox is dead in 1693, but Collins is still alive and pastoring one of the largest churches in London, and he's approached by the other men and asked to write a catechism that would go along with the Confession of Faith. And so he took the Westminster Shorter Catechism, supplemented it with a couple of questions from the larger catechism, added the Baptist doctrines in terms of believer's baptism, and that catechism, Baptist catechism, was published in 1693. And the leather-bound edition that Solid Ground Books has recently put out of the Confession and the Catechism is William Collins' 1693 Baptist Catechism, intended to go along with the Baptist Confession of Faith. Let me read to you a tribute that was written for Collins after he passed away. This was part of a funeral sermon that was preached just after his death. And the preacher said this: "The subjects he ordinarily insisted on in the course of his ministry were the great and important truths of the gospel, which he handled with great judgment and clearness. Oh, how he would open the miseries of the fall! And in how moving a manner would he discourse of the excellency of Christ and the virtues of his blood and his willingness to save poor, awakened, burdened sinners. His sermons were useful under the influence of divine grace to convert and edify, to enlighten and establish, being drawn from the fountain of truth, the sacred scriptures, with which he constantly conversed in their original languages, having read the best critics, ancient and modern, so that men of the greatest penetration might learn from his pulpit discourses, as well as those of the meanest capacity." Now, that's a great testimony that any pastor would be glad to receive at his funeral. But that's the testimony that was given of the character of William Collins. Well, there's one more man. There's two more men that I'd like to talk about. Time won't permit me. There's one more that I want to mention, and that's the man Benjamin Keach. Austin Walker, who's a Reformed Baptist pastor just south of London in a town called Crawley, has written a very good biography of Benjamin Keach. If you ever get the chance and are interested, you might want to read it. Keach is a lot younger than these other men, having been born around 1640. He lived until 1704. But he rises to prominence, and he's as famous as Kiffin and Knowles in terms of his reputation. Someone asked last night if I could recommend some books, and the first one I recommended was Michael Hagen's book, Kiffin, Keach, and Knowles, The Three K's. Keach originally was a General Baptist minister. He was an Arminian. When he moved to London, he married a woman who was from a particular Baptist church, and interestingly, around the same time, he himself becomes a particular Baptist. Now, I don't think that we should read that by saying he became a particular Baptist so that he could marry this woman. But I think that it may be that he became a particular Baptist, and in adopting those views, found this woman and married her. But he became pastor of a church in London in a place called Horsley Down, south of the Thames, in a section of London called Southwark, in 1668, and he spent the rest of his life serving that church. Now, he was the most prolific author of all of the particular Baptists, and he wrote 43 books. Several of them are still in print. Kriegel has kept in print a couple of his works, and now on the internet you can buy some others as well. It's actually very interesting. Now, the church that Keach served as pastor in Horsley Down is famous for another reason, Does anybody know why that church is famous for another reason? Well, it was the forerunner of a church that later came to be known as New Park Street Chapel. Does that give you a hint as to why it was famous? And a young man who was 19 years old was called to be the pastor of New Park Street Chapel. The church grew so quickly that they had to build a new building, which they named the Metropolitan Tabernacle. And the pastor of that church was Charles Haddon Spurgeon. So Spurgeon was the pastor of the same church, of course, 150 years later. But Spurgeon was the pastor of the same church as Benjamin Keach. And that church still exists today. I worshiped there on a Sunday last year, in June of 2009. And it was very encouraging to see that building filled to the brim with people who came to hear the gospel in a church that has existed since the 1640s. Keach is famous in England and America. One of the practices that we owe to Benjamin Keach is hymn singing in public worship. He developed a practice in which he wrote hymns, he composed hymns, that would be sung after his sermon on the Lord's Day morning. And any Baptist history of hymnody usually begins with Benjamin Keach and the story of his introduction of hymn singing into public worship. He was an interesting character, something of a controversialist, but also a man who was concerned with the spread of the gospel. We find him at several different times engaged in preaching missions to places to help churches planted to see people brought to faith in Jesus Christ. Really, he was a great leader. Well, time is just about out. I wish that I could tell you the story of Hercules Collins. I like to call him a mighty man of God. You can understand why. Another interesting character along the way. But it's almost 10 o'clock, and I want to give you at least one or two opportunities to ask any questions if you'd like to. We didn't even get to the churches that I hope to describe to you at this point. Anybody have any questions that they'd like to ask about any of these individuals, about their stories? Well, I wish that we did have some portraits that we could put up on the board to show you. I've been able to find, of course, the portrait of Kiffin is famous. I've been able to find engravings of Knowles, of Keach. I think that those are the only ones that we have. We are the heirs of these individuals and their churches, and we ought to honor their memory and thank God for what he did through them. Pastor Doug?
I have a question.
Okay.
You know, you speak of some of these churches, and the last one, you know, having this long history. And certainly many of the Baptist churches didn't have that kind of history. They've come and gone. But I think that what a tremendous heritage to be able to say we've been here for all these years. Could you just address that in terms of a local congregation? I don't know that we ever think in terms of our church being here 300 years from now. And could you just address that, the value of having a long-term vision and in terms of doctrine and practice and heritage? Is there merit in that?
Well, of course there's merit in that, because you want the gospel to go on from generation to generation to generation. I haven't sat down and actually done the research to identify how many of those 17th century churches are still in existence today. Of course, some of them have died out over the years. And some of them that still exist really are on the liberal side of things today. The one in Oxford, for example, it's called New Road Baptist in Oxford. It's really a liberal Baptist church. And the Broadmead Church would be broadly evangelical in the broadest definition of the sense. But Hercules Collins Church in London still exists as an evangelical church. Keach's church still exists as an evangelical church. The Church of Cox and Collins and Kiffin merged together. It still exists in London. Out in Bradford-on-Avon, Robert Oliver has been the pastor of a church that goes all the way back into the 17th century. There are some churches. How did they stay true? Well, I think, number one, it's incumbent upon them, the congregation, to choose leaders who are men of integrity and will uphold the doctrines of the gospel from generation to generation. It's important for the members of the congregation themselves to live lives of holiness and to understand the truth and to seek to teach their children those truths, bring up the next generation so that there's a level of commitment and fervency to those things. And I think that it's greatly beneficial to consider the long term. I have grandchildren now. What about my grandchildren's grandchildren? What will be the case for them? And it would be a wonderful thing if God in His grace continued and maintained our congregations so that someday they could sit among us and maybe tell our story. Not that our story is worth much to tell, really, but we're not. What can we do? Shine the shoes of these guys, maybe? We can at least tell their story, and maybe someday somebody would say, hey, I remember Pastor Doug and the work that he did in Fargo. That would be a good thing, wouldn't it? Yeah. Make sure you get a portrait done of him. Someday somebody can Google his portrait and find it.
Any other questions?
Well, that's Kiffin. That's the portrait. I realize that you're looking at a tiny picture from a distance, but you want to put it on the table and people can come up and see it. You can notice from, now this, remember yesterday I talked about a ruff. This is not really a ruff that he's wearing, but it's some kind of collar, a fancy linen collar. There's also some kind of jewel that he has down there on his chest. It's a really interesting picture, but that's Kiffin in the portrait.